Seminary. This was after a protracted debate over his book Inspiration and Incarnation, published in 2005. The chairman of the board told Christianity Today that a majority of the board concluded that the book was, quote, outside the bounds of the standards of Westminster Seminary and the Westminster Confession of Faith. That's the oath that all who teach at the seminary must promise to uphold. It declares, among a number of things, the divine truth of the Holy Scripture, whose only author is God. Enns argues in his book that Scripture is the work of both God and human beings. He asks his readers to think about the Bible the way they think about Jesus, both God and human, and he calls for a new doctrinal understanding of the Bible. Peter Enns has decided to leave Westminster. We invited him to join us on Radio Times today to talk about the ideas in his book and the questions that it raises. We did invite someone from the seminary to join us, but no one called us back. Peter Enns, nice to have you with us on
Radio Times.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Why did you write this book? And this book came out in 2005, so
correct.
It goes back a number of years. Why did you write it, and who did you think its audience was?
Well, I wrote it to benefit mainly younger evangelicals, but also others who lose their faith, essentially, over some difficult issues that have risen in the history of modern biblical criticism. And the audience, every book has an audience. You can't escape that. Mm-hmm. My audience was and still is those types of people who are unsatisfied for whatever reason with rather traditional answers to more contemporary and difficult kinds of questions.
So the idea was that in order to raise some of these questions and try to explore them, you might help people hold on to their faith rather than have them lose it because they were reading the Bible and things didn't add up, there were inconsistencies.
Right, or if people are exposed to some of these very common and obvious issues in modern scholarship. If they're exposed to these issues in, let's say, more hostile environments, which can be anything from watching the History Channel or public television, perhaps, or maybe a professor in a college somewhere who does not have their own faith journey in mind. These things can be rather unsettling. So for a good number of my readers, I'm actually assuming a strong familiarity with some of these things.
Right.
And I'm saying what you've been told is not the only way to look at these issues.
And why is it controversial, then, to think of the Bible as something that is made or written by both God and human beings? What makes that such a controversial idea within your faith?
Well, I think it's actually not. And that's, for me, one of the more perplexing issues about this controversy. You read something at the outset where the tradition that I represent feels that God is the sole author of Scripture. That's not what our tradition says. Our tradition is very clear that the Bible is somehow of both divine and human origin, let's say. I think, though, what is somewhat controversial, and there are so many ways of coming at this, but I think maybe the bottom line, what makes this controversial, is that in raising the issues the way that I do, I am perceived as conceding ground to a more liberal, let's say, wing of the Christian faith, particularly to certain aspects of biblical scholarship that evangelicals have spent a lot of time contending with.
Right.
And I'm saying rather openly, no, I think they're actually right. What's also ironic, though, is that I'm by no means the first evangelical to say these things. I'm just saying it in one cover, not in footnotes of an academic article. I'm writing for popular consumption. And I think that's created some of the concern on the part of some people.
Well, let's go back to some of the ideas, I guess, contained in this book, and I guess some of the ideas that got you into trouble. But you say the Old Testament has a historical context. In fact, you can look at some of the literature, some of the writings of the day, and see parallels between those writings and the Bible.
Right.
Give us an example of that.
Well, for example, I guess one of the more foundational examples that people always look at is the very first chapter of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1 tells the first of two creation stories in the Bible. And what happened in the late 19th century is that there was some archaeological discoveries that unearthed first a Babylonian creation story called the Enuma Elish, which is the first two words of that text in its original language. And scholars noted immediately the overlaps between Genesis 1 and the content of this ancient Mesopotamian text. And that is something that, you know, one of the points I'm trying to make in the book is that that is a fact that should actually influence how evangelicals right. understand the nature of Genesis 1. So, for example, by putting Genesis 1 in its historical context, you will be less prone to think of Genesis 1 as, let's say, a book that describes the creation of the world in scientific terms. It's not a scientific book. What these ancient texts do is they actually help calibrate for us what our expectations should be of Genesis 1. And that actually opens up all sorts of powerful and wonderful theological possibilities in reading Genesis 1, rather than just a defensive one, like, you know, we have to be right about the days of creation or something like that.
But it could it also raise questions that if you begin to see parallel stories in mm-hmm. other texts, raise questions about the divine inspiration for the Old Testament, because you begin to see patterns in other mm-hmm. either non-religious texts or non-Christian texts.
It depends. And that is why the analogy that I've used in my book is what I and others call an incarnational analogy, which I by no means invented. This is actually, I think, very prominent in my own tradition, the Reformed tradition. And it goes back at least to a 4th century theologian by the name of Athanasius, and probably earlier, of roughly trying to think of the Bible the way we think of Jesus. Jesus is a Son of God incarnate, made in flesh, who is in some mysterious, inexplicable sense 100% divine and 100% human. Not sometimes one, sometimes the other. Not 50% and 50%, but completely God and completely human. Right. And Jesus is called the Word in various places in the Bible. So Christian theologians have made this connection, saying, well, Jesus, the Word, capital W, is divine and human. Well, the Bible, lowercase w, Word, is like that. There's an analogy. And if you take that analogy to heart, things like parallels that you're mentioning are not only not a problem, but they're precisely what you would expect of a God who lovingly and wisely condescends into his own creation to speak the language mm-hmm. that the people are speaking. I don't expect a divinely inspired text from an ancient Mesopotamian culture to speak about creation in modern Western scientific terms. And if you do that, you actually obscure the message of the Bible.
You also found or write about the fact that the Bible contains, for lack of a better word, I guess, theological diversity. The
right.
idea that there are different ideas about what happened, maybe even different accounts of what happened. And the mm-hmm. question is, you know, if this is a holy word and mm-hmm. there are diversities or differences of opinion, how does mm-hmm. that get reconciled?
Well, it is, you know, a holy word, meaning it comes from God. But again, if we understand God as someone who, by his wisdom and by his pleasure, deems it proper to speak through people and people living in particular places and times. And then when you take into account the fact that, you know, scholars will differ on this question, but the writings contained in the Bible span at the very least 500 years, and some would say maybe even as much as a millennium, which is just a tremendous amount of time. And we don't always appreciate how old these things are and how long it took for the Bible to come together. When you look at that and when you understand that, you know, an Isaiah is not the same as a Moses or a Daniel or an Ezra or a David.
You're going to get different accounts.
You're
right?
going to get different points of view, which does make, I can't, you know, speak in reductionist terms, but right. it does make evangelicalism as a system a little bit nervous. Because if this book is written by God, it needs to be consistent. The point that I'm trying to make in the book is that, no, it doesn't. If God is speaking in a way of a confluence between a divine and human authorship, I would expect that diversity, which reflects cultural differences, even socioeconomic differences, all sorts of geopolitical differences in the Bible, you would expect different people to have different takes on different things.
But if one believes in the literal truth of the Bible and there's this diversity of opinion, mm-hmm. how does someone reconcile that?
I think it's very difficult to reconcile this with that type of what I would like to call a more fundamentalist position. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but more of a descriptive way. On the other hand, you know, I can say with full confidence, I think the Bible is literally true, but we have to define literary and we have to define true. When you have, to give a more commonly known example, you have the four Gospels in the New Testament, which really do tell the story of Jesus with differences, unavoidable differences. To deny that there are differences is to twist yourself into a pretzel. It denies one's ability to read. They're very obvious. When you look at those differences, if we presume, and this is a presumption, this is a statement of faith, that God is somehow behind this, we have to conclude that for whatever reason, even if we can't understand it, God wants us to have these four Gospels that look this way because they're each trying to get something different across. Jesus was a very complex historical figure. I sort of like the fact that we have four takes on his life and what he did. There is tremendous unanimity in the Gospels, but also there are differences of how things are presented.
Well, and we have a minute before our first break. I'm thinking of Rashomon, that famous Russian film that I remember where an incident happens and a number of people are all there and each of them comes away with a very different opinion about what actually happened.
Right. That's true. The tension, though, with evangelicals is that, but if God wrote it, that can't happen.
Because you have to come away with one story, I guess one truth associated with that story.
Yes, yes.
And you're saying we can live with a number of different stories because each of them has something to tell us.
I'm saying we'd better live with those stories because that's exactly what we have.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking today on Radio Times with Peter Enns. He's a former professor of Old Testament and Biblical, I don't even know how to say that word.
Hermeneutics?
excuse me. Just snuck up on me there at Westminster Theological Seminary. That's just outside of Philadelphia. Author of a book called Inspiration and Incarnation, Evangelicals and the Problem of the Old Testament. And he was suspended earlier this year by the board at the seminary, and they have decided to part ways. He has decided to leave the seminary. We were interested, though, in what his ideas and how it did create some controversy at the seminary, and we've got some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Virtua Musculoskeletal Institute in South Jersey offers a comprehensive orthopedic healthcare program that features minimally invasive joint replacement, sports medicine, and spine care, as well as pre-surgery therapy. As part of Virtua's rehabilitation program, they provide in-home physical therapy, a medically managed fitness center, and a bone health and osteoporosis center. Details at virtua.org or 1-888-VIRTUA3. Virtua Health supports WHYY.
Looking for a lush, fragrant screening plant that supplies a highly valued crop? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll hop into the idea of growing your own hops. Plus, chemical-free answers to an especially large selection of your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
When faced with a personal challenge, you can do two things. You can be overwhelmed by it, or you can work to overcome it.
Sometimes the difference between an ordinary and an extraordinary life is simply a matter of effort.
I'm Farai Chidea. Divorce Court's Judge Lynn Toler, next time on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Peter Ends today about the Bible, about religion, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before the break, you had talked about some of these contradictions in the New Testament, that mm-hmm. you've got interpretations of a particular story. You've got a number of different interpretations. Give our listeners an example of what you're talking about.
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, probably contradiction is not the best word to use. I'm not afraid to use it, but any presentation of historical event by multiple peoples will have different perspectives involved, and I think it's more helpful to speak of them as different perspectives than actual contradictions. But I think one prominent example in the Gospels is Jesus and his cleansing of the temple. If you read what are called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because they're very similar, so they're called Synoptic Gospels, you have Jesus cleansing the temple at the beginning of the Passion Week, which is at the very end of his life. In John's Gospel, which has a very different character and flavor than the other three, Jesus cleansed the temple in chapter 2 at the very beginning, or towards the very beginning of the Gospel. A more literalist interpretation would probably want to argue, and in fact this has been argued, that Jesus must have cleansed the temple twice, once at the beginning and once at mm-hmm. the end. I think a much more plausible and far less tense-filled kind of explanation is simply to recognize that the gospel writers have different purposes for why they're writing what they do. It may be that John is interested in highlighting Jesus' divine authority at the very outset of his gospel to make a theological point. And, you know, the analogy that I use with my students is just look at anyone's day and how things went. And if later this evening my wife asks me how my day was, and I might start with this wonderful experience of being on WHYY from 11 to 12, I might then talk about the traffic coming in. I might then talk about the wood that I'm splitting in my backyard afterwards. I've gone out of order, but I wanted to emphasize certain things, and so I choose to speak of them in a certain order and with a certain intensity or intentionality. That is recognizing that literary and I guess I'd say theologically creative dimension on the part of the biblical writers. And my point is that that is not inconsistent with divine authorship if that's what God wants to do. If he wants to talk that way, by all means, let's let him and not presume to know what a divine book should look like. Because we don't know that apart from what we have.
I don't know if you can answer this or not, but are you surprised that this book and your ideas got you in such hot water at the seminary?
A little bit. I mean, in retrospect, not as much, I think. I certainly expected differences of opinion outside of the seminary and, let's say, evangelicalism in general. But that's okay, because in the world of ideas, you have disagreements. And if everyone agrees with your book, you probably didn't need to write it. If everyone hates it, it's probably not a very good book. So, and I think I've pretty much struck a nice middle tone there. Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised, again, in retrospect, not as much, but in part because many of the ways in which I was taught to think about the Bible as, and I want to use that word again, as an incarnational product, are things that were taught to me by professors when I was a student at the seminary back in the 80s. So, there is some surprise, but no shock, I'd say.
No, I don't know all the details of this mm-hmm. oath, though, that people who teach at the seminary mm-hmm. have to agree to. It's extensive.
It's 33 chapters long. It's not for the faint of heart.
Right.
It's quite long.
But obviously, you read it. You signed it.
Sure, yeah.
Uh-huh. Would you say, because what my understanding from the board is that, and I'm just quoting here what they told Christianity Today, that the book was outside the bounds of the standards of Westminster and the Westminster Confession of Faith, that mm-hmm. they saw this as somehow that you did not uphold this faith that you had sworn mm-hmm. that you would uphold. Mm-hmm. Is that true, do you think? Or, I mean, have your views changed in the last 14 years that you taught at the seminary?
Not substantially. I do think that, all people's thinking develop and evolves, and I'm certainly not the same thinker today that I was 14 years ago. But I think that that's one area where the leaders of the seminary and myself have what I would call a legitimate difference of opinion, because right. there are legitimate differences of opinion in the world about what it means to be beholden to a particular confession, whether it's the Westminster Confession of Faith or some others. And we did have legitimate differences, not only about what the confession itself says, but what it means to be confessional to right. begin with. And I think those are points of view that where we differed, and the seminary is well within its rights as leading the school to make certain decisions about what they feel is inside and out, which is why the parting really truly was mutual. Right. It was amicable, and we've decided to go our separate ways.
So, well, something that, yeah. that you – I guess you've had this on a blog or something. You said, yeah. I believe that this oath does not mean that someone living today is bound to every word and expression found in the Westminster Standards, but to the, quote, system of faith that the standards articulate. Right. And in many ways, this is kind of what your book is about, which is the yeah. the kind of specifics or the system.
Right. Well, in my opinion, it's very much consistent with the system of, mm-hmm. of teaching that is found in my tradition,
right.
but certainly not every word. In part because the Westminster Confession of Faith is a mid 17th century document. It's frankly brilliantly articulate, but it's a 17th century document, mm-hmm. and a lot has happened in the world, especially the last 100-150 years. That I think thinking people have to take into account. And that's what I try to do in conversation with that tradition, in my opinion.
But I wonder whether, I don't know if this is just true of theological seminaries, where, you know, there is tradition, and some of it goes back more than 350
exactly
years.
Right, yeah.
But you also have, as you were describing, archaeological finds
right.
and new information about how you reconcile some of those mm-hmm. those powerful traditions mm-hmm. with new information.
Right. That is, I think, a perennial problem in the history of Christianity and Judaism. And, I mean, to go back to the very beginning, even in the Bible itself, the Israelites had to reconcile what was faith in Yahweh like now that we're in exile in Babylon. And a few hundred years later, now that we've been taken over by the Greeks with their Hellenistic culture, what does it mean to be a Jew today? This question is as old as the hills, mm-hmm. and what oftentimes happens is people of different opinions go in separate
sure.
directions. It's just what happens. It's quite normal, actually.
And some feel very under attack by mm-hmm. these new ideas as well.
They certainly do.
Very
yeah.
threatened.
Very threatened by them, and if God is truth, then the truth should not bother us. Of course, then we have to get to definitions of what is truth.
Of course.
and there's always an interpretive dimension when you're looking at, you know, an archaeological find doesn't interpret itself. You have to interpret it. The Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation story, doesn't interpret itself. People have had to sit down with, you know, the Hebrew text of Genesis 1 and the Akkadian text of this and say, what are the similarities and what are the differences? And scholars even disagree on what some of those similarities and differences are. Where they do agree is there is clearly some connection here.
I was interested mm-hmm. in this book. I'm assuming these are your three children that you dedicate the book to.
Yes.
And for Eric, Elizabeth, and Sophia, and under that quote, that's a very good question, dot,
yeah.
dot, 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 dot. Then you go on to say in the preface, I believe with all my heart that honesty with oneself is a central component to spiritual growth. God honors our honest questions. He is not surprised by them, nor is he ashamed to be our God when we pose them. He is our God, not because of the questions we ask, but because he has united us to the risen Christ, and being part of God's family is ultimately a gift to us, not something to be obtained by us. God has freed us in Christ and made us his children, and as all children do, we ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this book is about questioning.
Yes, it's not about giving firm answers, which is one of the sort of strands of criticism I've received. Pete, you're not giving straight answers, and I'm saying exactly right, because frankly, I don't have all the answers mm-hmm. to these questions, but what I'm trying to provide readers is with a theological paradigm for, again, watching the History Channel, reading Newsweek, or sitting in a freshman Bible as literature course, and not saying, I need to lose my faith now because mm-hmm. these things are, what I'm hearing is running counter to what I've been taught as a child in church. There are other ways that, again, are actually, they're implicit in much of evangelical thought. They're just not, in my opinion, made explicit. Mm. And what I'm trying to do is make something explicit for a very lay-level readership.
And you are an evangelical.
Yes.
An evangelical Presbyterian Christian? I mean, this gets, yeah. I guess, really complicated.
It
and then
is.
We'll get to our callers.
I have to charge you more to answer that question, Marty. Presbyterianism is a form of church government where you have elders. I'm evangelical, and I'm in the Reformed wing of that, which when I tell people that, they sometimes think I just got out of prison or something. But Reformed really means it's a way of saying, from John Calvin onward, who was one of the great reformers along with Martin Luther. And a lot has happened in the Reformed tradition in the past several hundred years. But that's the tradition that I'm a part of, which actually predates evangelicalism in America by several hundred years. But we've all sort of gone under that general umbrella.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Peter Enns, our guest today on Radio Times. For 14 years, he taught at Westminster Theological Seminary, that's just outside of Philadelphia, and a book he wrote a couple of years ago called Inspiration and Incarnation, Evangelicals and the Problem of the Old Testament, got him into a bit of hot water at the seminary. He was suspended earlier this year in the spring, and then ultimately he and the seminary decided to part ways, and he joins us today on Radio Times to talk about some of his ideas and how he thinks about the Bible and spirituality and God. And I should just add, because I said at the top of the hour, we did invite a representative from the seminary to join us in our conversation, and they did not return our calls. But we got a bunch of calls waiting to join us, including Bill from Wayne. Bill, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Professor Enns.
Hey.
My question revolves around belief versus dogma. There's a long history of antagonism between what Irenaeus, Bishop of Lyon, and Arius of Alexandria branded as heresy when questioning what is commonly accepted as canon. Yet in the light of the last few centuries of biblical analysis, documented by, you know, people like Bart Ehrman, there are grounds for positions such as yours. Do you think your situation is similar to those who have come before who are branded as heretics for questioning dogmatic canon? I think of the sects associated with the Gnostic Nag Hammadi texts. After all, Irenaeus' strong views were for the maintenance and cohesion of the fledgling church. Now, he's heresy here in the Greek meaning, that is, making a choice.
Bill, thanks for the call. I don't know if he's asking you whether you think you're a heretic.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm a heretic, and no one is saying that. I want to make that very, very clear. The seminary has in no way, they've actually said the opposite. Pete Enns is not a heretic. But the question here...
Did some call you a heretic, though?
Very loosely on blog sites and things like that, but, you know, blog sites will say anything.
Yes,
but,
they will.
But, you know, what's important in terms of the question is that, and also my own ecclesiastical body has not said anything about my being a heretic. The question here is a particular tradition within Christianity. And the issue is, do I, with my set of beliefs, belong in the Reformed wing of evangelicalism or someplace else,
right,
maybe more on the periphery or something like that? And I really think that's a legitimate question. My own opinion is that my own thinking is really a function of trajectories that I see within the Reformed faith. But that's a very, frankly, boring and intramural kind of discussion to be having. Most people can't relate to that. But those are more the issues that surround my book, I think.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But are you questioning where you think you belong within your church? I mean, as a result of some of the controversy about some of your writings?
Like, I think so.
You know, who wants me and where do I feel comfortable?
I'm playing the victim here. Nobody loves me anymore. But
I didn't mean to imply that at all.
No, I know.
But it's a kind of a search that you might be.
I definitely so. And it's not just for, let's say, doctrinal reasons, but it's also for, you know, for lack of a better word, sociological reasons. If you're in a certain Christian communion or in a particular setting, a seminary or a college or whatever, where there are certain values that are held onto, and they may, you know, accept you in their fold as being a peripheral type of person. I have to do some soul searching myself and say, do I want to be peripheral? I have been thinking, and not just over the past 6 months, but I'm always actually thinking about questions like that.
Sure.
Where do I best serve the gospel? Where do I best fit the way God made me to be, I guess.
And rather than always being sort of on the edges, someplace that would accept you sort of in the middle, so
yeah,
to speak.
More. And some would accept me on the other edge, the ultra-right-wing edge. It all depends on where you are.
So. Yes, it does. Let me get Joel to join us. Hi, Joel. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Dr. Inns, as a pastor, asking many of the same questions as young people and children, or just anybody who encounters biblical scholarship, as they ask new questions, do you advise that they look inside the tradition for fresh water, or should they look for categories and answers from another source? And my guess is that because you compare the Bible to the Incarnation, you're looking within the tradition as a fresh source, but I just wanted to hear your way of putting it.
Yeah, I think you've put that very well, Joel. I am looking from within what I would call Orthodox Christianity, which is something that's been around for a couple thousand years. It's not defined by just a few people. It's something that's a very broad tradition. And I do think we're actually it's incumbent upon us to look within. And, the Christian tradition is very, very diverse. Now, the problem, though, that you're facing, I would imagine, is as a pastor, you actually represent a particular tradition. And it's very hard for me to sort of answer that question because I'm not sure what tradition it is. I know in the Reformed tradition, there's a lot of, what I would call intellectual depth and breadth, where you can find things to hook onto to help you maintain a conversation with your tradition. But part of it, too, is I think the role of pastors in helping their congregants understand that all traditions are in a process of development. That is simply the human drama. You can't get away from that. Even a tradition that decides to sort of recalcify itself is in a process of development. That's a decision. That's a choice that they made. And I think, posing that sort of a tone or a mindset on the part of God's people is ultimately very, very helpful.
And Joel, we're almost up on a break here, but I'm assuming as a pastor, this is something you have to deal with, the kind of questioning from your congregation every day?
Absolutely. Again, especially as people are growing up and use that term postmodern.
Sure.
They need terms, they need categories, and I really commend Dr. Inns for using that incarnational category. I think that's very helpful for looking at the scriptures.
Well, I appreciate your call to Radio Times.
You bet.
Thanks a lot, Joel. And we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. We do have a full bank of calls. Peter Enns is our guest, and he taught for some 14 years at Westminster Theological Seminary that's located just outside of Philadelphia. He was suspended earlier this year because the board at the seminary had questions, frankly, about some of the writings in his book called Inspiration and Incarnation, and he has decided to leave the seminary and joins us this morning on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Every 4 years, Democrats and Republicans gather to nominate their candidates for president.
Accept the nomination of the Democrats.
I had the highest honor of accepting your nomination.
I proudly accept your nomination.
This year, John McCain and Barack Obama will accept their party's nominations. Join us starting August 25th for special coverage of the 2008 conventions from NPR News.
On 91FM, TV12, and WHYY.org.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Those are Michael Pollan's 7 words of advice for a healthy diet. This Friday on Radio Times on TV, Pollan joins us to discuss his latest book in defense of food. Then meet Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and journalist Geraldine Brooks. I'm Marty Moscoen. Join me for Radio Times on TV Friday at 8 on WHYY TV 12.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now, behind the scenes of Hillary Clinton's failed presidential campaign. Also, musician Elvin Bishop. He may have fooled around and fell in love, but his greatest passion is the blues. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Peter Enns today on the show. We've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Now, you were a tenured professor at the Theological Seminary. You've been there 14 years. In a non-religious academic setting, a university or college, generally tenured professors, unless they do something really outrageous, are essentially protected for their controversial ideas. That's in part the role of tenure, which is to allow someone to explore and even talk about things that might be deemed controversial. Tenure didn't protect you under these circumstances at the seminary. Should it have?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, a slight correction. It's not that tenure didn't protect me. It never actually got to that point to find out because of the agreement that we reached. But you know, a seminary is a seminary. It's not a university. There are more clearly defined boundaries at any type of, not just Westminster, but you name any evangelical school, and they have certain boundaries. And the boundary at Westminster is the Westminster Confession of Faith. That is the primary boundary. And if the leadership of the seminary feels that an idea oversteps that boundary, that trumps tenure. And again, which the seminary has every right to do. Yeah. The interesting discussion is, again, as I said before, is what does it mean to have a healthy, viable commitment to a tradition in light of things that have happened since that tradition actually came about.
Right.
And again, that's a place where there were differences of understanding, and you know, as we have it, I left the school. But you know,
because I thought it was interesting. I mean, the board majority voted to suspend you, but I noticed that the majority faculty voted to support you.
Yeah, that's true. And I think and all that is, you know, matter of public record. The board voted to suspend me, but the board, in order to investigate, rather than to suspend me because they've already concluded I'm a problem, that didn't happen. That would have happened at a hearing process,
right,
for example, which is part of the faculty dynamic. That's what's in place to sort of adjudicate these things. You know, it is true that there is a difference of opinion between the majority of the faculty and a majority of the board. And that makes things very interesting. Mm. But ultimately, the decision makers at any institution that has leadership is people like the board or whatever.
So, well, you parted ways. I mean, it was an amicable parting, as I understand it, reading from both sides. But do you regret that there wouldn't have been a hearing? And just that, I mean, the hearing allows for people to discuss and debate and hear both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that I'll probably be thinking about on and off for a few months, not obsessively, but just wondering. Mm-hmm. But I think the purpose of our discussions with coming to this agreement is that at the end of the day, it would not have benefited anyone who's involved in this in any positive way. Nothing good probably would have come of that. And I think it's good for me and it's good for the school, mm-hmm, to have come to an end the way that it did.
Let me get Kaylee from Havertown to join us. Hi, Kaylee. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling as an adjunct professor of American religious history on the college level, and I wanted to say that I find Pete Enns' work crucial for teaching contemporary college students who are encountering the Hebrew Bible and Greek scriptures for the first time, precisely because it does ask the questions that students are asking. But I wonder if Pete's suspension from Westminster is an unfortunate repeating of history. As some of your listeners may not know, Westminster Seminary was founded out of a theological protest by faculty against the teaching at Princeton Seminary the 1920s and 30s during a time known as the Fundamentalist Modernist Controversy. And at that time, when several faculty sought to continue more biblical teaching versus more modernist theology, Princeton Seminary was reorganized so that the administration was given power over the theological agenda versus the faculty. And I wonder if the action of Westminster's board in some ways parallels this, parallels, ironically, this historical precedent where the faculty who have supported Pete's scholarship have in some ways been rounded up and ignored.
Kaylee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can you speak to that, Peter Enns?
Yeah, I think that there is a parallel. And to be honest, Kaylee, I hadn't really thought about that parallel until now. But I think, you know, what will happen governmentally at Westminster remains to be seen. I don't know at this point whether the board is sort of taking over and disenfranchising the faculty or anything like that. It could be. I don't know. You know, I think in this particular instance where, let's say, the will of the faculty was, you know, trumped, I guess, by the board in their decision to suspend, you know, I guess that is a rough parallel where and an ironic one where an administration or board decides to go in a certain direction. The irony, of course, is that at Princeton, the administration and board wanted to move the school in, let's say, a more liberal direction, and here it's the exact opposite scenario. And I just find that from a historical point of view interesting, but not sure what to make of it.
Kelly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We've got Jim now from Pittman. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. As someone that was, you know, raised Catholic and spent 16 years, including college, in Catholic schooling, and became, during college, an atheist / agnostic, which I remain to today, I think I sort of fit into the group that your guest was speaking to, and I do think if I had had that kind of way of thinking about Scripture, that kind of elasticity, I may not have broken away so quickly. I don't know if it would have ultimately changed my perspective, but because of the insistence on rejecting evolution, because the church would split with another faction of the church over whether or not priests literally changed bread into the body of Christ or only symbolized it, I really got disillusioned, you know, while I'm reading the ancient Greeks and all these other things, and I just wanted to say that I think that, you know, there may be some people that your guest keeps on board because of his reading.
That's pretty much it. Jim, that's interesting. Do you miss your faith?
I miss a faith at times, having anything other than that sense that we're all just walking out over the void or whatever. I mean, it's a little distressing.
Kind of existential point of view.
So, yeah, I do find myself, and maybe I should pick the book up, and maybe something that helps me, you know, sort of rediscover that. I don't know.
That's interesting, Jim.
You know, Jim, I think one thing that I might want to encourage you about is that, you know, one of the sort of sub-themes of the book, and I come to it a couple places, is that, you know, what we see by God getting involved in, let's say, the messiness of history, and in a book where God is very involved in the everyday lives of people, let's say, even to the point where God is said to change his mind, and God is sorrowful, or God does this and that, what that communicates to me from the Bible very clearly is the lengths to which God will go to be next to us. And I think the problem sometimes that is posed by various Christian traditions is sort of a Platonic God who's way up there someplace, and occasionally he makes a guest appearance. What the Bible really describes is a God who will have none of that, who's with his people walking and talking and speaking. And, you know, maybe that's something for you to think about. The God that you've been presented with may not have been the God that the Bible talks about. And, you know, we're all prone to that, including myself. We make God in our own image, but, you know, that's why continually going back to the Bible, not to a particular tradition, may actually help your faith and not hurt it.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Have you had doubts, though, in your faith? You seem to allude to that just a moment ago.
I can't imagine anyone not having doubts. Read the Psalms, and they're full of doubting. Read the book of Ecclesiastes and Job. Doubting is part of anyone's religious journey, which is why, you know, in the preface to the book that you so kindly read before, you know, ultimately, I believe that it does come down to the grace and love of God of holding on to me rather than me holding on to him, because I'm just a person. I can't do that.
Yeah. You use the word defensive, and I scribbled down some some, not just necessarily quotes, but just some things that were said about the, quote, defensive posture of evangelicals to new discoveries. And mm-hmm. and when you talk about that reaction or that response to new discoveries, what are you referring to? And I know the Scopes trial is probably one of those examples, but mm-hmm. what are you referring to specifically?
Well, I think there is, let me say first of all, I think there is, at least in popular evangelical circles, a general tone of defensiveness. I don't mean to imply that every evangelical scholar is defensive except for me. But there is, when things come to light that challenge a system, the tendency is to defend the system in light of the discovery rather than allowing the discovery to nuance or change or to make the system somehow adapt to what is out there, so to speak. Mm. What's really interesting is that in evangelicalism, 100 years ago, positions that would have been considered completely out of bounds are nowadays, you know, oftentimes and regularly accepted by evangelical scholars. Well, such as, for example, the relevance of Babylonian myth to understanding Genesis. That was at one point in time sort of a no-no. You don't talk about that. It's still hard to talk about because people can lose their jobs, but it's something that you will see in evangelical literature. What doesn't happen is sort of connecting the dots and saying, okay, in view of this, what's our Bible like? What does it mean to read it? How do we understand it? Mm-hmm. Another quick example might be who wrote the Pentateuch? That is a very old question actually goes – it predates the modern biblical scholarly period. Was it written by Moses or someone else at a much later time? Mm-hmm. Moses would have lived sometime around the middle to late portion of the second millennium B.C., evangelical scholars that I read acknowledge that the Pentateuch probably didn't come together until what's known as the exilic period when the Israelites were in Babylon, which is in the 6th century. Doesn't mean it was written then, but it was brought together then by someone who lived, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years after Moses. If you had said that in evangelical circles, let's say in the 1880s or 1890s, you would have been in a lot more hot water than if you say that today.
So it does adapt, but it sounds like the adaptation is slow and with a lot of protest.
I think so, and my main concern here is not, I want to run evangelicalism. My concern is with people, like my children, for example, who have taken Bible's literature courses in high schools and colleges, who need different paradigms by which to think through some of these things that do create tensions with older models. But so be it. I think that has to happen.
Because this is the world that they live in. You're saying these are 21st century young people.
Right, who have access to information that 150, 200 years ago no one had access to. Things have changed dramatically.
Let me get to Comey from Burlington to join us. Hi, Comey. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Doctor, I have this burning question pertaining to
go ahead.
Pertaining to, I believe it's Genesis 2, chapter 4, verse 14, where it talks about, do not eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, or surely you shall die. Now, to me, that says, do not participate, do not consume the knowledge of good and evil. It doesn't say good or. In any of the versions I've ever read, it says good and evil, or surely you shall die. And to me, that also says that prior to the disobedience, which I see as the original sin, disobedience, there was not to be any death. But after the disobedience, then death came upon us. What say you to that?
Okay, Comey, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Can you
speak to that?
I think very, very briefly. That's actually a huge question with a lot of complexity interwoven in it. But the injunction, you can eat of the tree of life, but not of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, implies that, by disobeying that injunction, what was brought into the world was death. And Genesis is very, very explicit about that. But I mean, there are all sorts of very interesting things we can't get into at this hour about what good and evil meant in the ancient world, what life meant, why a garden, you know, why a talking serpent, things like that. That it just it's there's too much in just the few minutes that we have, I guess.
So. Colby, thanks for the call to Radio Time. So, Peter Enns, what are you going to do next? And this is after 14 years of teaching at the seminary.
Well, I mean, for now, I have numerous writing projects that I have some spare time to get to. I have several speaking engagements over the next few months. I'm doing some adjunct teaching as well in about three or four institutions, just, you know, two-week kinds of intensive things. But I'm also looking forward to just relaxing and taking stock of things and, you know, working hard at my writing, but still being able to just breathe some fresh air and to really think about what that next move is going to be. I'm not sure at this point.
Are you surprised, and we're almost out of time here, but are you surprised that this, your case, your story, got so much attention?
Yes, I'm very surprised.
Are you unhappy about it?
No, I'm trying to say happy or unhappy about it puts the focus too much on myself. I think if this is something that will, at the end of the day, help people with real struggles of faith, then, you know, it doesn't matter whether I'm happy about it or not. I'm surprised that it's gotten the attention that it has, although, you know, it's certainly the case that I think there's a general interest in spiritual matters in our culture, and I think people are looking for meaning, and I think many of those people are trying to revisit, like one of our callers, a tradition that they left behind for what I would say are very, very bad reasons.
Well, Peter Enns, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Yeah. And we appreciate the phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Jonathan Best helping us out today. Deborah Lissick and Susan Greenbaum, senior producers of Radio Times. Patty Leswing is the producer and Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.